You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
More than anywhere outside of Asia, North American museums are filled with stunning and expansive collections of Chinese art. Institutions like the Met, the Cleveland Museum of Art, and Washington's Freer and Sackler Galleries are home to particularly impressive collections. But how did so much Chinese art make its way to America? In their new book, The China Collectors, Carl E. Meyer and Shireen Blair Brysack tell that story and address the questions of whether these works belong in to the Chinese institutions that currently house them or in China. The book is published by Palgrave Macmillan Trade, and I'm very pleased to welcome Carl and Shireen to our show today. Welcome back, Shireen.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Why do North American museums have greater holdings of Asian art than most European museums? In the 17th and 18th century, wasn't there a strong demand for Chinese goods, particularly silk, porcelain, and tea, in Europe?
Yes, initially the Europeans were the collectors of just those items, porcelains in particular. But then after 1870, when the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and the Met were established, there became a vogue for Buddhist art, large sculpture, and that was really an American thing. The American museums are full of it, the European museums not so much of it.
But that's mostly from India.
No. The Buddhist sculpture from China. China has a very big number of Buddhist caves. This was the Great Silk Road trade route, and Buddhism came to China from India, but there's a lot of Buddhist sculpture, much of which landed in American museums.
Were they mostly bought and sold, or how much was stolen?
Well, there was some looting going on after about 1907, when there started to be photographs of all these caves and things. Dealers would sort of send off photographs to some local intermediary who would hire peasants to chisel it off. So a lot of it was looted, ended up in antique shops in Beijing, and eventually made its way to New York, Boston, etc.
Carl, well, even earlier, what about the opium wars?
We had America had a head start for a very practical reason, that in the 1780s, the shipping routes to Europe were caught up in the Franco-British wars, and American ships were being seized and so on. And therefore, canny American merchants were looking elsewhere to trade, and there was the China. And the very first, it was 1785, a ship called the Empress of China came to New York Harbor. It was the first ship to reach China, come back. And 2 years later, the Grand Turk arrived in Salem, and it was the first ship from New England to get to China. This started a trade so lucrative that one of the things that's very surprising, the very first American millionaire was the owner of the Grand Turk. His name was Hesketh Derby. And in 1800, the city that he lived in, Salem, was per capita the richest city in the United States.
And Massachusetts was sending missionaries all around the world, especially to Asia, Hawaii, for example. Were they sending them to China already?
Oh, yes. We were early in the missionary thing, and missionaries were one of the reasons that we've acquired a lot of Chinese art.
The missionaries would take the art and bring it home?
Yes, and in the case of Canada, you had a bishop, an Anglican bishop, who worked with the people who were going through the tombs and feeding the market, and he got a lot of the best stuff for the Toronto Museum.
Has there been a debate developing that would be similar to the arguments about the Elgin marbles, which were taken from Greece and installed in the British Museum?
Oh, absolutely, and by coincidence, the central figure in the debate is Lord Elgin, the 8th Earl of Elgin, whose father was the man who reputedly ransacked the Acropolis. And he was in charge of the Franco-British troops in the Second Opium War in 1860. And he was outraged when the Chinese, in his view, murdered a peace delegation. And as an act of vengeance, he ordered the destruction of the Summer Palace. And the Summer Palace covered 1,000 acres and hundreds of buildings. And there was weeks of looting, and that was the beginning of the spree of grabbing stuff from China.
Also, the century of humiliation, which is what the Chinese call it, which started in 1860 with the Opium War and then didn't end until 1949 with Mao.
Do they see the all of this, their art treasures going elsewhere as part of that humiliation?
Yes. What they really are concerned about are the items that were looted at the end of this opium war, the Second Opium War, which ended up in the British Museum, the V&A, the museum in Fontainebleau in Paris. This was mainly done by the British and the French, the looting. Now, what happened then, of course, in 1900 was the Boxer Rebellion, and the Americans participated in that looting, what happened after the Boxer Rebellion, when they gave a rebellion and everybody came.
Was there a stronger appeal to Chinese art than Indian art or Japanese art? And Europeans went absolutely bonkers over Japanese art, and it influenced a lot of artists, a lot of the post-impressionists.
Right. Well, that was in the sort of Art Nouveau period in French art. Initially, the same thing happened in America. Japanese art was initially more appreciated more than Chinese art. Japan was easier to get to. It was kind of friendlier to people like Henry Adams and various people from Boston who went there to Japan. Isabel Stewart Gardner went. Charles Freer went. They also traveled on to China. Isabella Stewart Gardner's museum is in Boston. Of course, the Freer Museum is in Washington. So they traveled on to China, but many people just stopped in Japan.
When and where did the first American exhibit of Chinese art take place?
In Philadelphia, and Nathan Dunn. And then that was succeeded by the Great Chinese Exposition in Boston. These were sort of early world's fairs, except they only exhibited Chinese art. And the idea was to show that the Chinese would make very good trading partners for the Americans.
Yeah, the Boston Exhibition was in 1845, and it was shortly after the U.S. signed its first official treaty with China. In which we had access to the trading ports, and also we secured immunity from Chinese law for the Americans who were working there. And so this was all part of the exploitation then of the great new market in the East.
Well, up until the Opium Wars, there was a problem with trade with China because China was self-sustaining. It didn't really want to trade with Europe. Europe wanted China's things, but China didn't necessarily want Europe's things.
Well, yeah, what happened then was all this, the Chinese insisted that they be paid in silver bullion. So all the silver bullion was going to China, and China wasn't buying any of the stuff, hence the Opium Wars. Now, the interesting thing about the Opium Wars is the French and the British are always blamed because they fought the war. However, Americans were up to their necks in dealing in opium. Some of the great American fortune, the Delanos, as in Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Forbes, the Peabodys, these guys were all into the opium trade.
So when I was taught in high school that the open door policy was something, an example of American idealism, that wasn't really true?
Well, the open door policy was a bit of verbal, how can I put it, chemistry. And it was, according to George Kennan, who wrote a wonderful essay on it, it was really to help secure the reelection of President McKinley. And in fact, in the open door is that we were going to get equal access for all people, all countries in the parts of China we wanted to. But when it came to the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and our areas, we had our own exclusion policy.
Duan Fang, a prominent Qing dynasty official, was one of China's most successful art collectors around the turn of the century. How did he get involved with Western dealers?
Well, he was the greatest collector of his time, and he particularly was known for collecting ritual bronzes. These are things that are buried with people to see them through their afterlife. They contain food and things like that.
So they were breaking into tombs?
Yeah, they were breaking into tombs. Now, what happened was the railroads And Duangfang was involved with the railroads. He later became the head of the Chinese railroads. Well, what would happen is they were digging for the railroads. They'd unearth all these tombs. Now, most Chinese didn't want to collect. There was sort of a prohibition, you know, with your ancestors to collect things from tombs, but that didn't deter Americans. And Duangfang was always interested. Most of these ritual bronzes have writing on them. And he was very interested in epigraphy, so that's why he collected them. And unfortunately, he came to a very unhappy end after helping Charles Freer and all these people became friendly with a lot of Americans. But at the time of the great beginning of the rebellion, which overthrew the last Chinese dynasty, the Qing dynasty, in 1911, he went out to try and quell a rebellion, and he was executed by his own troops.
Beheaded, actually.
And what happened to his collection?
Well, the great centerpiece of his collection is now in the Metropolitan Museum, which is this only set of ritual bronze, an altar set. Now, they're sitting together in pride of place at the Metropolitan Museum. They were legally bought from his heirs. The heirs had to ransom his head as he was beheaded. And so that cost quite a bit of money. And they later sold the collection onto the Met.
Langdon Warner, an archaeologist with Harvard's Fogg Museum, traveled in 1923 to the Dunhuang Caves in Gansu Province along the Silk Road, and he found cave paintings. Who had painted them?
Well, these were mainly Buddhist caves, and the various monks had painted them. And he knew about them before. Sir Earl Stein and Paul Paleo, a Frenchman, had gone there in the early part, 1903, 1904, 1905, 1906, 1907, and discovered these caves and all their paintings. So by the time Warner got there, they were well known. And he was sent by the Fogg to really bring some of them back. But they weren't really made like European frescoes. We call them frescoes, but they're not really prepared in the same way. The ground is not prepared. So when he went with his barrels of glue to get them off, the glue froze and the pigment, a lot of it stayed on the walls. So when he brought them back, and it was 15 weeks getting them back to just ship them to the Fogg, by the time they got back to the Fogg, there are only about 5 of the 12 that he took that can be exhibited. The rest of them were really in such bad shape.
How do you remove frescoes off of a cave wall?
What you do is the glue should be hot, which is part of his problem, and it's you put it onto basically fabric, and then you stick the fabric and the glue onto the wall. And
the way they took the frescoes off of Florence.
Yeah, this is the way they did it in Europe, but the walls are prepared before they put the frescoes on in Europe, so this worked in Europe, but it didn't work on these caves.
Now, how do historians view Langdon Warner these days?
Well, it's three things. One is that he helped train a whole generation of leading curators and specialists, museum directors, and has a very positive legacy in that. And two, he is credited with, although he denies that he was solely responsible, for saving the key cities in
Kyoto,
Japan,
and Nara, the two great cultural cities,
from being bombed during World War II, and is honored as a hero in Japan for that. Then finally, as a collector, he was a pioneer, and let's be quite honest that he was quite honest. He had very mixed feelings about what he was doing as to whether this was salvation or whether it was taking away the heritage of another nation.
You know, part of the problem is that China in the 1920s was overrun by warlords. The white Russians were retreating through China. They were defacing some caves. There was a possibility of a Muslim rebellion in the West. So things were really in a bad state. And this is an argument that people make now. If he'd left these things in China, maybe they all would have been destroyed. So better there in the United States where they could be loved and studied.
The same argument that we hear with the Elgin Marbles.
Exactly.
In
similar.
Now, one of Langdon Warner's students was a man named Lawrence Sickman, who was curator at the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City, one of the great holders of a Chinese collection, the other being the Cleveland Museum of Art, where Sherman Lee was in control for so many years. How did they facilitate the growth of these major collections in not major cities?
Well, first of all, Larry Sickman was one of the star students of Langdon Warner, and who helped promote him. And he came to China, got fascinated by China at just the time that the Nelson Atkins Museum was founded with a very significant, a large endowment. And he was given a big budget to buy. And this was the 1930s when there was a lot to buy.
There was a lot to buy there, whereas if he wanted to have a European collection, there wasn't much on the market. Some other museums, like the Brooklyn Museum, did similar things with Egyptian art and African art, because you could build up a pretty great collection still on a budget in those days.
That's right.
You couldn't do that anymore, could you?
No, certainly not in China, where there are implacable laws against the export and so on.
And now China is the largest art market in the world.
Well, it's also the hottest art market, and there was this incredible sale about 3 weeks ago in New York of the last of the great dealers, Robert Ellsworth. And the estimate for what that collection, it was a five-day auction, would bring, the estimate was $35 million. It went for $131.6 million, his collection. So you can see. No, museums really are out of the business now, American museums. It's all going back to China. It's restitution Chinese style.
My guests are Carl E. Meyer and Shireen Blair Breisach. Their book, The China Collectors, America's Century-Long Hunt for Asian Art Treasures. Wasn't Charles Lang Freer, the founder of the Freer Gallery in Washington, D.C., originally interested in collecting Western art? What led to his change of heart?
Well, first of all, he became friends with someone named Ernest Fenollosa, who was the great prophet of Japanese aesthetics in the turn of century at the time. So he became initially interested in not only Japanese art, but in avant-garde American art, like James McNeill Whistler and others. Then he discovered China, and it was like a revelation for him. And he focused primarily on Chinese art, and he assembled a great collection, and then he decided to offer it to the American people. This was 1908. And the Smithsonian Institution was a very mixed feelings about it. And Theodore Roosevelt tipped the balance and said, we've got to get this collection. They did. And that set the precedent for federal underwriting of museums of art in the United States. There are now seven or eight others in Washington that are the siblings of the Freer Gallery, which opened in 1921.
What are most of the pieces in these galleries? Are they mostly porcelains, or do we have a lot of paintings?
The Freer has a number of paintings. He was very early into early ceramics, where his contemporaries like J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller Jr., they were into collecting Qing Dynasty, the colored, you know, Femme Noir, Femme Rose. These are things with lots of birds and flowers, the kind of vases that you see in museums. That was what his contemporaries were collecting, but he had a very good eye. He also had very good advice. He was always interested in learning something and talking to people who did know something. So he was able to buy just really the best of what was around. I mean, Freer was probably the best, most knowledgeable collector of his particular time.
And could I add a footnote? That he was very troubled by what was happening to the sites in China. And he commissioned the very young Langdon Warner to go on a two-year trip to persuade the Chinese to set up a new museum and a school for archaeologists. But alas, it was in 1914 when World War I broke out, and nothing came of his initiative.
You also write about Canada's unusual history with Chinese art, especially Toronto's Royal Ontario Museum. So this is an America's thing?
Well, they also had a big missionary presence, the Canadians. The missionaries really didn't manage to convert many people, but they did collect a lot of stuff. And they were very successful when they established hospitals. Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller Jr. established the Peking Medical Hospital in Beijing. And that was very successful because they taught the medicine, and they healed people. And that worked out really well. But the missionary thing, lots of Christian converts, not so much.
The Chinese government has called for a return of some of these pieces, Carl?
Well, it's a very interesting thing that the Chinese government has not formally and officially asked any American museum to return anything. They've called attention to what has happened. But what they've done as in the economy in general, they've privatized their restitution thing. They let millionaire collectors do their bidding, so to speak, at auctions we just had one in New York, in which the majority of great buyers were Chinese, wealthy Chinese collectors who came here because this is the best place to buy Chinese art.
Don't they also continue to find new art treasures every time there's an archaeological dig?
Yes, it's the amount of sites is mind-boggling because you've got 2,000 years continuous of a single culture.
Wasn't the Beijing government very angry about all the art treasures Chiang Kai-shek took with him when he moved everything to Taiwan?
Yes, right at the end when he was fighting with Mao, they did, they only took half the treasures. What is interesting for people in the field is it really represented native Chinese taste in the 1910s and 1920s, which was for early painting, early ceramics, whatever. Well, when they finally opened up the Beijing Museum, what's now in Beijing, there's all this much later painting, very interesting painting, and now the canon has changed. And now people like the Met and all see that this was, exhibit Ming and Qing painting as something that's really very interesting. So it changed the taste.
What about the canon changing during the Cultural Revolution, which was anti-intellectual and anti-past?
Absolutely. And what happened in some of the cities like Shanghai is that the museums colluded with collectors to conceal works of art from the Red Guards that were going around destroying it. And yet the Chinese did a turnaround on it, starting with, I think, the archaeological discoveries near the old capital of Xi'an, where all the terracotta warriors were found. And now you have the Cultural Revolution is a lost and forgotten chapter. You don't hear about it when the Chinese talk about their art.
Now, are there ownership disputes today?
Yeah, mostly on the things that have come either that were looted at the end of the Opium War. David Cameron, when he visited China, was Twittered asking about when they're going to return the objects that are in the British Museum, of which there are a great number of, particularly from these Dungwong caves that were taken by the Hungarian Sir Earl Stein.
Well, how do you think that these problems can be resolved?
Well, one way that can be resolved is by collaborative loan exhibitions. And another way is that which is something quite extraordinary, that if you go online, you can see a lot of these treasures that are scattered around the world at no cost whatsoever, so that we have truly a museum without walls online, which changes, redefines the question of access to works of art.
We've been talking about museums. How many treasures are in private collections?
Oh, no idea. But the eventually you see a lot of people do donate their collections to museums. And that's been traditional. I mean, the big example are the Rockefellers. Generations of Rockefellers have populated all the museums, mainly in New York. But we have a lot of their treasures.
My guests have been Shireen Blair Breisach, who's the author of four books, an award-winning documentary producer for CBS News and contributing editor of Archaeology magazine, and Carl E. Meyer, longtime foreign correspondent and editorial writer at The Washington Post and The New York Times, editor of the World Policy Journal. They have collaborated on a book called The China Collectors, America's Century-Long Hunt for Asian Art Treasures. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. And my great thanks to both of you for being on our show.
Well, and thank you.
Thank you for having us.